This morning's scripture reading is taken from the Sermon on the Mount. And when you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by others. Truly I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father who is unseen. Then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you. And when you pray, do not keep on babbling like pagans, for they think they will be heard because of their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him. This then is how you should pray. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread, and forgive us our debts, and as we also have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one.
We're now in week 5 of this 7-week series we're calling Presence and Power, the subject of which is being filled with God's Spirit. Not just knowing about God or believing certain truths about him, but feeling him and experiencing him subjectively, even being controlled by him. So we had a shift in our series last week. From what we've been talking about the 2 prior weeks before, we've been talking about these negative emptying practices you engage in to create space in your life for God, the things you do to clear some room. So we talked about getting rid of busyness, we talked about developing a hunger and thirst, and then last week we made a shift and we started talking about these positive practices that you can engage in to actually be filled. What do you do to be filled or to experience God more fully? So the first one we talked about last week was singing, and we talked about that first in part because of some personal experiences I had 2 weeks ago, which I shared with you, and also because I kind of wanted to throw you a curveball for this first one. A lot of people said, singing, what? That's the answer? And that was intentional. I thought that was one of the benefits of talking about that first. That's one of the first things you can do to be filled with God's Spirit is to sing. This week, we're coming to the traditional, conventional answer, the answer you should have been expecting, which is to pray. The conventional answer to the question, how can I be filled with God's Spirit, is, well, you need to pray. And it's the traditional, conventional answer because it's the right answer. Just like we saw last week, how there's this connection in Scripture between singing and experiencing God, being filled with God. Same thing when it comes to prayer all through the New Testament. I'm not going to take the time to walk you through the passages, so just take my word for it. There's this connection between praying and then all of a sudden you experience God. You feel God. You have God in you at a more subjective level. So we want to figure out how to do that, because we all know that we need to do it. We all know why we should do it. And in this sense, it's a little bit different than last week's subject of singing. Part of my job last week was just to convince you it's a little bit more novel, so to convince you, yes, singing is important. You do need to do this. But when it comes to prayer, everybody prays. Everybody knows that they need to pray. Every person in here already prays. They just feel that they should be praying more, and they feel that they should be praying better. We know that we need to pray. We just need somebody to teach us. Unfortunately for us, there's this gold mine of a passage in the Gospels where Jesus speaks in response to exactly this question, Lord, teach us to pray. It's this rare, beautiful example where he actually just answers a question straightforwardly. You know, the disciples say, Lord, teach us to pray. And normally, he almost always answers questions with other questions. So you expect him to say in response to this, well, why do you want to learn to pray? Or, you know, pray, what is this pray? What do you mean by the word pray? Something kind of dodgy. And he's like a good therapist in that sense. You know, if you've ever gone to counseling, your therapist mostly just keeps asking you questions. And just about the point where you're getting really frustrated, and you're thinking, what am I paying you for? They finally will tell you to do something. And that's what Jesus does here. He finally says, okay, I'll tell you how to pray. Here's how. In response, he says, first, here are 2 wrong ways to pray, 2 bad models of prayer. And then here's the right way to pray. Here's the right model of prayer. So that's what I want us to look at together this morning. First, the 2 wrong ways to pray. Second, the right way to pray. And then lastly, some practical considerations about making this happen. Those will be the 3 sections to this morning's sermon. First, the 2 wrong ways to pray. Second, the right way to pray. And then lastly, some practical considerations about making this happen. So first, the 2 wrong ways to pray. First thing Jesus says when they say, how to teach us to pray, is right off the bat, he says, well, don't pray like this and don't pray like this. He has 2 times, verse 5 and verse 7, you see that phrase. And when you pray, do not. And when you pray, do not. And that's interesting in and of itself that Jesus is willing to be negative in order to be positive. And it goes against something you might have heard somebody say at some point along the way, which is, well, there's no wrong way to pray. That's false. There's actually a lot of wrong ways to pray, and Jesus identifies two of them here. The other thing I've heard people say before is, well, you know, I tried prayer, and it didn't work for me. And if it's true that there's no wrong way to pray, then I guess that's prayer's fault. But if there is a right way and a wrong way to pray, then if you tried prayer and it didn't work for you, it might not be prayer's fault. You might have been trying to do something with it that it's not intended to do. So, for example, at our house, we have, like most of you, a toaster, and you put a piece of bread in it and put the lever down. A couple minutes later, a piece of toast pops up. It actually works pretty well for making toast, but it doesn't work very well for, say, frying an egg. So if you were to come over to our house and try to fry an egg in our toaster and say, well, this toaster's worthless, it doesn't work, it's slightly less than accurate. That's not really the toaster's fault. It's more the way you were using it. And that's the way a lot of people approach prayer. They're not using it the right way. Jesus says, here's two wrong ways to pray. What's the first wrong way to pray? Let's look at the passage. This is up on the screen as well if you want to follow along. He says, and when you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by men. So who's he talking about here? At first you think when he says street corners, you think of like a religious fanatic, a crazy person. You know, you picture this person standing in Times Square with a sign draped over them, shouting their sermon or their prayer, and you know, nobody's paying them attention because it's New York, nobody cares. But that's not who Jesus is talking about. When he says street corners, he's talking about literal street corner, the place where two streets intersect. In other words, the town square. So he's talking about praying in this civic situation, you know, a public function, or the synagogues obviously is praying in a worship service, in a formal religious setting. So he's not talking about radical people, he's talking about respectable religious people. Those are the people he's calling hypocrites. Of course, there's nothing wrong with praying in a public setting, praying in a civic function, or praying in a formal worship service, unless that's the only place you pray, unless there's no private prayer to match that. Because what Jesus is saying is, if that's the case, that you only pray in those settings, and you don't go to your closet and pray alone, then why are you really praying? It doesn't seem like you're praying to connect with God. It really seems more like you're praying to connect with other people. It's more just of a social thing. And there's a type of prayer that's exactly that. It's just about saying, this is who we are as a people. This is kind of our culture. So, for example, when a politician closes a speech by saying, and may God bless America, that's a prayer, ostensibly at least. You know, it's in the form of a prayer, but it's hypocritical because the politician usually doesn't have a private prayer life. The people listening usually don't have a private prayer life. But the people listening say in the focus groups, we love that. We love it when he says that, which is why the politician says it, because he's seen the results of the focus groups. And everybody feels better about themselves and pats themselves on the back because what? This reinforces this cultural heritage that we have. Every culture has this default religiosity. So if you were to ask an average person, you know, why are you a Muslim, or why are you a Catholic, or why are you a Presbyterian? The person, if they were being honest, should say, because that's where I'm from. That's my people. I'm Italian, so I'm Catholic. I'm an Arab, so I'm Muslim. I'm from Tennessee, so I'm a Baptist, or whatever it is. It's just, these are my people. And a lot of types of prayer are just about reinforcing that. You're just saying the things that our people have always said. You're hearkening back to the traditions of our people. And it's just about reminding each other who we are as a people. And it's about you, if you're the prayer, being a respectable member of that group. You know, so everybody can say, oh, look at them. They're part of this group. And it's about saying we're upstanding citizens and we're upholding family values. And Jesus says, gag me. You know, don't do that. That's not prayer. It's not appropriate. It's interesting, actually. It's the exact same critique of religion that Nietzsche leveled. Nietzsche said, that religious people oftentimes are just being religious in order to build their reputation, in order to get a self-image, in order to have a platform so that they can exercise power over other people. And this was supposedly this big groundbreaking idea when Nietzsche came up with it, but he just stole it from Jesus. Jesus had said thousands of years earlier that there's a type of prayer that's just this religiosity, and it's not really talking to God at all. Now, before we move on from this first wrong way of praying, let me just take the gloves off for a second and make sure that the good Christian folk in the congregation feel the full force of this by pointing out that when Jesus wants to define hypocrisy, this is the place he goes. He goes to, do you have a private prayer life or not? And what he's saying is, if you do all the things that are involved in being a Christian in terms of public, in terms of the things that other people can see, if you do all those things, but then you do none of the things that other people can't see, why are you really doing it? Your Christian life is clearly just for show. And if you think I'm being harsh with you, you've got to realize that I'm not just preaching to you, I'm preaching to myself too, because who's most in danger of this? The guy who's praying up front behind the microphone every week. So it's not like we do it. Well, our test for hypocrisy to make ourselves feel better, because if you haven't done these particular bad things, our test for hypocrisy are sex and money. So we say, well, he pretends like he's this upstanding person, but he's having an affair on the side. Hypocrite. Or he pretends like he's this do-gooder, but he's taking an exorbitant salary and living lavishly. Hypocrite. Those things are hypocrisy. That's not the way Jesus defines hypocrisy. The way he defines it is, do you pray when you're around other people, but then you don't pray when you're by yourself? That's being a hypocrite. And this is getting a little bit uncomfortable, so we should move on to the second wrong way of praying. Let's look at the passage. We'll put this up on the screen as well. Verse 7, he says, and when you pray, do not keep on babbling like pagans, for they think they will be heard because of their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him. So when he says babbling like pagans, he's actually talking about a group of people, the pagans. And in the first wrong way to pray in verse 5, he's taking aim at religious people. And the second wrong way to pray in verse 7, he's taking aim at irreligious people who also pray. Everybody prays. Prayer is this irrepressible human tendency. You can't not pray even if you're not religious. And he's saying not only do the religious people pray wrong most of the time, but the irreligious people pray wrong most of the time too. So what do they do wrong? What do the irreligious people do wrong when they pray? Well, he uses this word babbling, which obviously sounds pejorative, but what does that word babbling mean? We can figure it out from the context. He says they use many words first, and then second he says, don't be like them, for your Father already knows your needs, is the key phrase, before you ask him. So when he's talking about these pagans babbling, this thing that he doesn't want you to do, he's talking about rehearsing your own needs with many words, using a lot of words to tell God all about your own needs. He says, don't do that. Of course, it's not just irreligious people that pray this way. It's also church people. You know, for example, you feel worried, and you know that when you're worried, you're supposed to pray. And so you go to God in prayer, and you tell him all of the things you're worried about, which I don't know if you've noticed, never makes you feel any better, because you've just focused on everything that's got you upset. See, everybody knows that prayer is supposed to be the antidote to worry. It's said many times in the Bible. Jesus says it here in Matthew 6. He says, don't be anxious, pray. Paul says it in Philippians 3. Don't be anxious, pray. Peter says it in 1 Peter 5. Don't be anxious, pray. But the way that prayer neutralizes worry, I think, is widely misunderstood. Because what you do is you think, okay, so I'm supposed to talk to God about these things. And you go and pray and say, God, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, don't let this happen. And that's not prayer. That's just worry with the word God in front of it. Instead, Jesus says, you got to pray in a way that actually deals with your worry. And it's not like this. This is the wrong way to do it. If you pray like this, you're trying to fry an egg in a toaster. So those are the two wrong ways to pray. Let's move on to the second section of the sermon, the right way to pray. In this section, we're looking at the text of the Lord's Prayer, the most famous prayer of all time, the Our Father, if you grew up Catholic. Not only the most famous prayer of all time, probably the most famous, most well-known string of lines of any kind in the world today. But just because you know it doesn't mean you know what it really means or what it really signifies. Martin Luther said it like this. He said, how many pray the Lord's Prayer several thousand times in the course of a year? And if they were to keep on doing so for 1,000 years, they would not have really prayed or tasted it at all. You can say the words without really knowing what it means. So what I want to do this morning is just get a couple of things out of it. We won't have time to look at everything. We've actually preached an entire sermon series in the past on the Lord's Prayer. But this morning, just two observations from the Lord's Prayer. The first of which focuses on the first two words, Our Father. It's the most famous part of the prayer. As I said a second ago, it's the name of the prayer for a lot of people. And it's the most famous part for good reason. It's the most distinctive part. It's the most original part, the most groundbreaking part. And it sets the foundation for everything that follows. Because when Jesus says, you have to open your prayer by saying, Our Father, what he's saying is prayer is not about being an upstanding citizen like the religious people have it. And prayer is not about getting what you need like the irreligious people have it. Prayer is essentially about relationship. It's about being in a relationship with this family member, with this friend. It's about spending time with someone you love. And you're not really praying unless you do it on family terms. If you don't start like this, if you don't start with God as your Father, focusing on that relationship, you're not really praying at all. It's the one thing, the only thing that you have to do to pray. We are looking at this passage, the Lord's Prayer, in Matthew 6. It also appears in Luke chapter 11. And in Luke chapter 11, it comes right after a passage we looked at 3 weeks ago, which is the story of Mary and Martha. So you remember that? We just talked about it a couple weeks back, where Martha's busy and not paying attention to Jesus. Mary's sitting at Jesus' feet. And Jesus says to Martha, this is the one thing that's necessary, sitting at my feet, spending time with me, enjoying me as a friend. What we didn't say a couple weeks back when we looked at that passage is that commentators have observed that when Jesus uses that phrase, this is the only thing that's necessary about Mary, because he was someone that was so seeped in the Psalms, he had to have in mind Psalm 27, verse 4, where David says, one thing only will I seek. This one thing will I pursue, must I have, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. David says, just like Mary, the only thing I have to have is to actually enjoy his company, to gaze upon his beauty. And David, by the way, was not like a monk who had nothing better to do. You know, this is a very busy person who is, he's running for his life half the time. He's always in crisis. He's a general. He's a king. And yet, he says, this is the one thing I need, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. Not success, not safety, not protection. I just need to experience who he is. Why? Because if I can do that, if I can really experience his beauty and his greatness and his majesty, then I know that whatever else happens, I'll be okay. I won't be shocked. I won't be overwhelmed. I won't be disappointed because I've got this. It's the first thing you have to do when you pray is cultivate this relationship. It's about God being your Father and you being his child. It's the first observation. The second observation is that not only is it about God being your Father and dwelling in this relationship with him, it's also about, prayer is also about surrender and trust. And here we're looking at the phrase, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. Those are phrases of surrender and trust, and those are phrases that also happen to run exactly counter to the natural stance of the human heart. Because the natural stance of the human heart, and you'll hear this in yourself if you listen to yourself throughout the week, the natural stance of the human heart is, my kingdom come, my will be done. And Jesus is saying, you have to lay that down. That's what prayer is about, letting go of that and surrendering to God, knowing that he knows better, which is actually just another aspect of, or part and parcel of, God being your Father. Because if he's the Father, what that means along with that, the corollary truth, is that you're the child and you don't know what you should know. You don't know as much as he knows. You have a limited perspective. One of the just kind of fixtures of my life as a parent of 3 kids, 5 and under, is just this daily routine of meltdowns and tantrums, just revolving door all day, every day, just one kid or another crying, screaming, collapsing in a puddle on the floor. It's just normal. It's great. And what are these tantrums about, really? It's about the kid, you know, so I say no to something, obviously, usually for some very arbitrary, silly reason. Like, no, you can't play with that because you'll get electrocuted and you'll die. But it feels arbitrary. The point is, it feels arbitrary and silly to them. You know, they think it's arbitrary and silly, which is why they melt down. Dad, how could you be so unfair? How could you be so unreasonable? How could you be so mean? This is ridiculous. And what they're saying is, my kingdom come, my will be done, and you are getting in the way of that. You're messing that up. And of course, it's the exact same thing with us. We as spiritual four-year-olds, essentially. I mean, what is worry? Worry is us saying, God, I don't think you're going to get this right. I'm upset that you might not get this right. What is bitterness? What is resentment? It's us saying, God, you didn't get it right, and I'm upset about it. I'm throwing a tantrum because you messed up. You didn't get this right. My kingdom come, my will be done. Jesus is saying, do you know how great it would be to just lay down that crushing burden, to admit that you actually don't know better, and to surrender to God as your Father, not just as someone who loves you, but as someone who's totally in control and has a much better plan and much better understanding of things than you ever could. So the second observation from the Lord's Prayer is you have to surrender, you have to trust. That's what prayer is about. And if you pray like that, it does work. Because when people say prayer doesn't work, what they mean is, I asked for this thing and I didn't get it. And it often won't work if that's the way you use prayer. But I dare you to use prayer like this, to just go to God day in and day out, saying, God, I want more of you. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. God, help me to experience you as a Father. I want to be filled with your Spirit. Please fill me. Please control me. Try that. And if you do, you'll see that prayer works just fine for what it's actually intended for. If you look at both of these observations together before we move on to the third section of practical considerations, just one last thing to note, which is that the first half of the prayer, we just looked at two of the phrases, but if you look at the whole thing, the first half, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. There's no mention of you anywhere in there. All of the stuff about you, give us this day our daily bread, the stuff about withstanding pressure and deliverance from evil, all that comes later. And what Jesus is saying is, the main thing you need is to just for one second stop thinking about what you need and immerse yourself in God instead. And then prayer will do what it's supposed to do. So those are the first two sections of the sermon. That's the substantive part of it, the wrong way to pray and the right way to pray. Now I want to close with some actually very mundane stuff. We're not heading toward a big finish here. We're actually just slowly petering out with some really nitty-gritty details about how to make this happen in your life. Because I started at the beginning saying, we know why. We know that we should pray. We just need to know how. So we spent most of the sermon talking about how. What are these things you're supposed to do in terms of approach? But there's still three questions that remain unanswered, which are where and when and what. So where and when are you going to pray? Actually, like location and time of day, and what are you, when you sit down at that location and at that time of day, what do you do? You know, because it's one thing to say, well, you're supposed to pray in such a way that it cultivates a sense of God as your Father, and you're supposed to pray in such a way that you surrender and trust him. But what do you, you know, when you're sitting there, what do you actually do? And I think this is where most people's good intentions to pray and their motivation to pray come to nothing because they don't have a plan in this area. So what I want to do is I want to take away all your excuses, and tomorrow, if we have your email address already on file, tomorrow you'll be receiving a document. And in the document, I'm going to give you options, basically, for both of these areas. I'm going to give you a list of options when it comes to when and where to pray, and a list of options when it comes to what to do to pray, just kind of different activities you can engage in. Let me just give you a brief kind of overview of this, what you're going to see in the document so you know what to expect. In terms of when and where, this is very basic stuff. Like option number one, you can get to work a half hour earlier if you have a quiet place at your work. If your office is quiet in the morning, you can pray there. Or you can go into a literal closet in your house if you have one that's big enough, which is what Jesus recommends. He talks about a closet and pray there in the morning or in the evening. Or you can pack a lunch and eat your lunch really quickly at your desk and go during your lunch hour and find a place to pray. So there's nothing on this when and where list that you couldn't come up with yourself. The point is just to remove any possible hurdle so that you don't even have to now think through what are my options here. And you can see a list of different options, and there'll probably be some that you have, that ideas that you have that even aren't on the list, and you can pick one of those when and where options. And I should say, too, that what I'm recommending is that you start with 30 minutes twice a week. So there's kind of two schools of thought on this. Everybody basically agrees that you should be praying at least 30 minutes every day. And everybody agrees that if you're not praying 30 minutes a day, it's really silly to start trying to pray 30 minutes a day. That's not going to work. So the two schools of thought are, some people say you should try to pray like a minute a day and then up the time every day, 5 minutes or whatever. I think it makes a lot more sense for a couple of reasons that I'm not going to go into now, to start with 30 minutes, but just to do it twice a week. And then if you do that for 4 or 5 weeks, then you maybe add a day, do it for 3 days. And then you do that for 4 or 5 weeks and add a day. And, you know, so many of you have tried to start praying 30 minutes a day 20 times in your life. So don't try that first. First try 30 minutes 2 times a week. And maybe by the end of the year, you'll be praying 30 minutes every day. And so then in terms of what you do while you have this time slot, before we go to that, let me just say on the when and the where, this 30 minutes, you can do this. You know, I know that you're busy and got so much going on. You think you're so freaking important, but you're not as important as you think you are. And it's not as hard as you think it is to find this 30-minute slot twice a week. I mean, it's very doable. You know, people do this. People start habits all the time. It happens. It's not going to happen if you know, are just kind of haphazard about it and think, oh, I kind of like to do that. But if you're serious about this and you actually try, you make an effort, you can do this. It'll take some trial and error. Maybe, you know, the first time slot you pick, maybe it doesn't work. Fine, you pick another time slot. Stay at it. Take a long view. And within a couple months, there's no reason on earth, there's no legitimate reason on earth why you can't do this twice a week. It's just not hard in terms of other things that really are hard. It's very, very possible and very doable. So then in terms of what do you do with these 30 minutes twice a week with this time slot? The thing not to do is to sit there and close your eyes and try to pray in your mind. That's a very legitimate way to pray. It's a terrible way to learn to pray. It's actually a very advanced way of praying. It takes a tremendous amount of focus and a tremendous amount of energy. I do not recommend you start with that. Instead, you need some sort of help or some sort of aid. And so on this list of what, there's going to be things like you can read through some psalms aloud, or you can write out your prayers to God, journal some prayers. You can buy a prayer book of written prayers and read through those aloud. You can sing like we talked about last week, all these different options. And same thing with when or where, you just choose one or two of these and you try them. And you know, you mix and match. You can try a couple of them one day and try a couple of them the next, and you find what works for you. And now you actually know what, when I say what works, what that means. By working, I mean what cultivates for you a sense of God as your Father and what helps you to feel this sense of surrender and trust. And it's going to be different for every person. You just have to keep playing with it until something clicks, and eventually it will. So as I said, just petering out. No big finish. That's it. Tomorrow morning, tomorrow afternoon, let's say. Tomorrow evening, maybe. It's done already, obviously. I just have to put finishing touches on it. Check your email, and you have no excuse now. I'd like us to become a church that prays. Let's begin by practicing together now. Let's pray. Father, you are our Father. You do love us as a Father, and we forget that so easily. We come to you with all these requests and all these things we need, and we come to you with such definitive plans of what we think needs to happen. And you just want us to spend time with you. We know that. So we ask that you teach us how. We ask, like the disciples asked, that you would teach us to pray. We ask, as we use the human effort and human willpower that you've given us to do this very small thing of just setting aside a time twice a week, that you would come and meet us there and you would do the rest. You'd take the little bit we're giving you and work with it. Draw us to yourself. Help us as we experiment with methods of prayer. And help us to find a way to really feel your presence on a daily and weekly basis, to experience you in private, not just in public, and to be changed as a result. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.